tape off. I'm so sorry.
Hi, I'm Bob Bazans. I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God and AA since the 10th of December 1967. For that, I'm very grateful. It's good to be here. It is, I confess I wanted to catch a plane after last night, but that was an extraordinary start for a wonderful event. I want to thank Lee for the opportunity of being here. It's a lot of work involved in this, and Lee has been involved in helping other people put these together, and it's a special event. Every time I'm around Lee, I get one of the things in my life I wish I had done better is how I was as a parent. And when I see Lee, I am strongly reminded of parenthood. I think he is one of the most wonderful single or double parents that I have seen, and that's always cool. I'm glad to be here with the other presenters. And one of the reasons I like to go to events like this is it encourages me. I come away from here a little bit more willing, a little bit more open, and a little bit better member of AA. It is, and what happens here is whenever we're at meetings, and especially events like this, there's a collective consciousness in the room. It's like we check a little bit of our minds, or we check our minds at the door, and we come in and we join the collective mind. And it's like, for people who meditate, it's easier to meditate in a group than it is to meditate alone. There is something about, it's like drafting. There is something in that experience that just opens the space. And that's how I feel about being in this room. Last night, you know, Joe did a little overkill on admiring the older speakers, and then he showed us up. Which reminds me of one of my favorite jokes. There's a minister on a bench reading a newspaper, and there's a great big hill. There's a kid on a bicycle on top of the hill. The kid comes down the hill. He gets going too fast. He goes head over tea kettle, falls down, bends the wheel on the bike, tears his pants, and cuts his knee. And he stands up and he says, "Son of a bitch." And the minister goes over and says, "Son, don't talk like that." He said, "When the next time this happens to you, I want you to stand up and say, 'Jesus, help me.'" 6 months later, same minister, same park bench, kid's on top of the hill. He comes down the hill, head over tea kettle, bends the wheel, tears his pants, cuts his leg, and he stands up and he says, "Jesus, help me." And the cut heals, his pants gets repaired, and the wheel straightens out, and the minister says, "Son of a bitch." It is. Which is partly the miracle we see in others that we can't see in ourselves. It is cool. I'm here to talk about step three, which is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Probably one of the greatest phrases in our fellowship is "God as we understood Him." It is such a powerful, such an opening. And if you look at Bill and Bob's background, it is just, and you start looking at the history of AA, it is so extraordinary. Sandy talked about last night what we decided to keep and what he decided not to keep in the fellowship. One of the other wonderful things that Bill did is he explained, as the program came through him, it's not about the disease as much as it's about the alcoholic. Had we approached this from the medical standpoint, if our interest had been too much in the disease, we would have had a bunch of complexities and lacked the understanding. And only just recently, when I was home, we had a radio program on NPR dedicated to a guy who was, I think, maybe head of the psychology department at Harvard, talking about why the 12-step programs don't work. And which isn't horribly funny. I mean, it is, you know, because he's saying it works as well as any kind of random sort of spontaneous thing. And I was listening, And it's a little threatening. You know, you don't want to listen to, you know, a well-credentialed person saying there's no statistics and go through that. And, of course, that is absolutely not our experience. But after about an hour of listening to this guy, you could tell he didn't get it. I mean, it was from a scientific standpoint. It was about addiction. He really didn't understand the emotional and spiritual aspect of our disease. I mean, the constant question we get asked, you're sober 10 years? You still go. Why? Well, there's a lot of explanations for that. Most of us know what those explanations are. They don't get it. And it looks like a crutch. It looks like, in some cases, could look like a cult. It looks like they're trying to get us to believe something. And yet, in many ways, there's nothing in AA to believe. There's a lot of things to experience, and there's a guideline. Sandy Beach is probably my very favorite person in Alcoholics Anonymous to listen to. I think he's a little further down the road than he's my chamberlain. I don't think he likes that, but he is. His gift of language, his gift of metaphor, his insights into what he has studied, especially the last 10 years, we have been the recipients of that, and it has been very cool. There aren't many people who can, when he talked about simplicity, there aren't many people who can get to that essence. You have to have a pretty big engine, or a small engine. either one is okay. to get to the simplicity of us and our program. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember that I was 23 years old. I had my last drink when I was 24. I had a large liver. I'd been diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. I had many of the mistakes that people make in alcoholism I hadn't made because I was so young. But I screwed up every single thing that I had the opportunity to screw up. Probably the largest of which is I lost my commission in the Army and I walked out of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. Amongst everything, amongst just trashing my family and all the work that they had done. I could not get my arms around the idea that I was an alcoholic. I knew I had a problem. I thought, you know, but I couldn't explain all the chaos in my life with the swallowing bourbon. It was much too complex for that, and I thought whatever he was telling me is that a drinking problem, why don't you quit? And of course, Clancy, probably best known for, if you're an alcoholic, drinking is not your problem, it's your solution. There's an underlying problem. And I remember I went to my sponsor and I said, I want to start doing the steps. And I don't know how to start doing that. In those days, we were not quite as studious about the book. You know, we read the book. I went through, you know, as I was starting this process with my sponsor, I read the 12 and 12. And in Minnesota, 95% of our meetings were closed-step discussion meetings. They still are about 80% closed-step discussion meetings. It's all we do. Some people think that's too heady or intellectual, but, you know, every place in the United States has its own personality. And that's what our founders did. We just kind of continued to do that. So I wasn't like I was unfamiliar, but I didn't know, how do you do the first step? You can't explain how you do the first step. Sometimes at these Woodstocks, we get pretty philosophical and pretty intellectual. It'll take an hour and a half or an hour and 10 minutes to talk about the third step. It's kind of a dangerous thing to do. The instructions on the third step is the first thing I'm going to do, and they are to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understood Him. That's the third step. That's about all there is in theory. It's 3.5 pages in the big book. And you can only do that at the level of which you can do it. You can only do it at the level of your own understanding or misunderstanding. When you're sober 3 weeks, 3 months, your understanding is different than it is when you're sober 3 years. And that's all you can go with. Sometimes we talk about everybody who does the steps has the same result. Yes and no. I really think that as we deepen our relationship with the steps, our experience alters. What we're looking for is an alteration. alteration or an improvement in our consciousness. If your consciousness doesn't change, nothing's going to change. It isn't like when we came in here, we were acting inconsistently with the way we saw things. We were acting consistently with our view of our life and what was happening to us. And it was in chaos, and it was, you know, burnt to the ground around our feet. And yet it was, we were doing the best we knew under the circumstances and what we saw. If I had a magic wand and I could remove every problem that everybody has in this room, on the condition we come back to this room in 10 years. If you came back to this room in 10 years, if we had not altered our consciousness, we would have recreated the problems we had sitting in this room today. The only way, you know, so as my business partner who just celebrated 50 years said, see it or be it. If you don't see it, you are it. When you were a practicing alcoholic, you did not see it, and that's what you were. When you saw it, you woke up to it, and you had an opportunity to have that altered. We talk about the great blessing, as Joe said so aptly last night, you know, you don't have to buy a lottery ticket. You won the lottery. You're in the room. There's only a very small amount of people who get in this room and a small amount of people who are able to engage themselves in the process of recovery. And you're here. This is, you know, this is it. Just before the fourth step, the book talks about that first we get well spiritually, then we get well emotionally and physically. It's one of the few things in the big book that I have argued with. It seems to me that we get well first physically. Now, I was pretty young. And then we start to get well emotionally, and then the most sophisticated thing that we do is the spiritual, and then we get well spiritually. I've reversed that. I've come to think that the way Bill said it is exactly the way it is. Something happens to us, and most of it is invisible. And we talk a lot about surrendering, but I think the fact is we didn't surrender, that we were surrendered. There is a difference between surrendering and being surrendered. When we hit bottom, most of us, our historical relationship is to start digging ourselves back out or wallow in the mud. It's still an ego experience. There's a guy I read and he talked about, but when you really hit rock bottom, when you really realize there's no way out, when you really realize that you're caught in a disease that's literally killing you and you are powerless to do anything about that, you don't hit just rock bottom. You fall through the trap door. A trap door opens and you are falling. And the process in some ways that we are in the program today, there's no landing. There's only falling. It is that if we can stay in the position somewhat, I remember when Chamberlain one time, we had a talk at the Peach Tree or Peachford Conference that Conway Hunter did. I remember he was talking about going there, and I was at a conference with him about 6 months later, 3 months later, and someone and it's a conference where all the experts on alcoholism go, and he was asked to be a presenter. And someone asked him, what do you think about all the experts on alcoholism? And Chuck said, they don't know much about surrender. It was like he put his finger, as he often did, right in the middle and touched the thing that was. So the greatest gift that we have in the room, I think, is our surrender, is our collapse. There was nothing we had to, in order to be able to hear the message, to open up, to be able to engage ourselves in the process, our egos had to collapse. But even beyond that, what happens is so spiritual, it's beyond the ego. It's so, when you hit bottom and keep going, there is this opening that is extraordinary. And that's where the light comes in. And it's where our brokenness is. I think that throughout our, and the danger that I have found in my own recovery is that we start collecting information. We start studying, only out of conference-approved literature, of course. But the mind wants to understand it, and the mind wants to control it. We are so steeped in the idea that we can control our own lives. And I think as you get deeper into recovery, you discover not only are we powerless over our disease and is our life unmanageable, we are powerless over life, and life is unmanageable. Now, how you engage in that process, it doesn't absolve you of responsibility, but you start getting the idea that I can cooperate with it And when I'm not using my own power, it's kind of like running on empty. There is a power that goes through us. We are like soaker hoses. You know, we all have holes in us, and the power that comes through us, we are the vehicle which the power comes through, and each of us has a different spirit, a different soul, and a different personality, and expresses itself. I love what Sandy talked about, the individuality of the program. So when I went to my sponsor and said, I want to start doing the steps, what do I have to do? He said, you know, what do I do with the first three steps? And he said to me, I don't think people would as much say this today, he said, I think you've already taken them. Which I said, pardon me? He said, look, I told you when you came in here, if you went to a couple of dozen meetings, you diagnosed yourself. Do you think you're an alcoholic? I said, yeah, I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, I think you've taken the first step. Pretty simple. I had Joe had a retired mailman. I had an active mailman who was... He was a 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was my sponsor for 43 years. We had 100 years between us when he died, as Sandy had the same experience. He wouldn't have been a guy that you'd have come talk about the book, but he was my book. He lived the book, and his wife was Linda's sponsor. I'm here with Linda, which is always better than not being with Linda. It's a little hard because people like Linda better than me, but... He said, I think you've taken step two. You've come to believe. He said, you go to more meetings than anybody else around here. You know, he said, I think you've come to believe that there's a power greater than yourself, be it Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, or God. And by looking at your activity and your interests, I think you've made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of that power. And that was about as simple as it got. And I've got an hour and 15 minutes to, you know, kind of go on that. But the simplicity, which Sandy so aptly talked about last night, is where it's at. But as a new person in Alcoholics Anonymous, most of us come in and our attention is on abstinence. We came in here with our pants on fire and we wanted relief. And the list that we would have made, you know, what do you want, kid? You know, I don't know, even if I could have answered it, but I would have put down a list of, you know, five or six things. Most of the essential things that I really needed on the list, I wouldn't have put on. And if you asked me to put them on, I wouldn't have put them on because I wouldn't have understood them. So the first couple of years, I think most of us attend to cleaning up the consequences of our disease. And when the consequences of our, and we see some of the most extraordinary, wonderful things that people do with their lives in the first couple of years, it is just astounding. That's kind of why that joke I told in the early part, we keep looking at this power that is coming through this person who doesn't know Jack. And he's breaking ice. I mean, it is just, you know, you look at it and you know. And what happens in that process of collapse, when the ego collapses, our pilot light gets lit. And that is the initiation, in my mind. That is what Tandy talked about, the Big Bang. That's our pilot light being lit. If we can keep the cardboard up around the guy or gal so the pilot light doesn't go out, and keep them in the middle of this new conversation that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, that person's entirely different. Prior to that happening, we lived our lives in a tank, looking out through the slit, hanging onto our 30 caliber machine gun. We did not, you know, we were isolated, different, and separate. We didn't like conversation. The things that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, a power greater than ourselves, surrender, give me a break. Those were not barroom conversations. I mean, they were so different. The language was different. The subject was different. The idea was different. It was of zero interest to us. And we came in here with an idea that I just got in a car accident. I need someone to fix my car. We really weren't even dealing with the idea that we were the driver and in trouble. We just wanted the car fixed. We wanted the circumstances changed. We wanted improvement. We wanted to get out of the trouble we are. And we spend a significant period of time and we start to answer. The early guys, when you call up and you make the mistake of asking your sponsee how they are, and they do the dump. Okay? And that's literally what they do. They take the internal dialogue and vomit it through the phone and tell you what's going on. And it is about the issues. It's all circumstance driven. It is the car. It is the spouse. It is the girlfriend. It is the boyfriend. It is the IRS. It is the legal problems that I have. It is the felony. It is the, you know, the jail or whatever the hell problem we're facing at that moment. Somewhere along the progression that this person goes through, the person calls, you ask them how they are, and they say, I'm okay. I'm a little nuts, but I'm... All of a sudden, the attention is not on any of the circumstances. The attention is how they're dealing with the circumstances. The attention is on their reaction to the circumstances, and their attention is on doing it somehow in the context of what their limited or what their understanding is of the AA program at that moment. Remember, I'd go to the meetings early and I'd stay late, and my sponsor sponsored a lot of guys, and I would kind of be the mouse in the corner. I would sit on the end of the couch where my sponsor was talking, and there was no conversation about not drinking. It was all conversation about, I got in a fight with my wife, I'm in trouble at work, I got to make amends, how do you, you know, and I was somewhat surprised by this, but it was one of the most extraordinary. So as we continue to get sober, and as we continue to recover, we start to get presented, I believe, with a better understanding of our defects of character and shortcomings. They start coming at us different than the consequences of our drinking. And if we're in the early part, we're so busy dealing with relatively serious consequences, patching up relationships, getting our life back in order, that we don't have always a very good sense of our defects of character. My first inventory was the worst. It was a confession of the worst behavior that I had. It wasn't very insightful, and it did not get to the cause and the conditions of my alcoholism. But after about 2 years, I started to get a pretty good list of my defects of character, and one by one they were handed to me. My unmanageability at work. Couldn't get to work, couldn't stay at work, couldn't work at work. My unmanageability with money. I have always spent more money than I made. I'm a materialist. I'm deeply shallow. You know, it is... I am. It is, you know, then you start, we started to have children and a whole new, Joe talked about a little last night when he had that first interaction with his child, the love reaction. When we started to have children, remember I went to, it's like, I was an angry, sometimes violent person with my children. I am not proud of that, but that's accurate. I remember going to a psychologist, and he said, were you an angry kid? I said, no. He said, my hunch is you became angry when you became a parent. My father was a fairly angry guy in that relationship. And we just switched roles, and I started to be my father, and my son started to be my son. And it was like someone took a computer program and booted it up when I became a dad. I'm responsible for everything in this computer program. Don't get me wrong that I'm trying to say I was at the effect of something. I was a cause in the matter. But I had a brand new, I had never booted that program up. I never needed that program. I didn't boot up, you know, in each new area of our lives. You know, I think we've got a computer program kind of on the shelf that is full of a hell of a lot of data that we think the computer program's empty. And we're going to fill it up. So during my... kind of like year two to year six, I'm getting in touch with my defects of character and I'm working on them. Now, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a wall built around me that said, you know, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me. I hate me. Who knows more what a lousy, insufficient, incomplete person I am than me. I'm comparing my inside with your outside. I started to tear that wall down in Alcoholics Anonymous with conversation with my sponsor, and I tore it all the way down to the best of my ability when I took my fifth step. I made a discovery. I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings. And I started to have a sense of hope that would work for you, could work for me. prior to that, we have this profound sense of uniqueness, a profound sense of difference. If you don't tear that wall down to some degree, you look for the differences. You do not identify. If you do not identify, it's a real problem staying around here doing the work with any efficacy. But what I did in AA is I say, okay, you got me sober, I'll learn how to be a dad. You got me sober, I'll learn how to work. You got me sober, I'll do this, I'll do that. Because, I mean, you've given me the tools. And I wasn't able to do it. I found myself in 6 years of sobriety in serious trouble. I started to build a wall back up. Thanks a lot for helping me with my drinking problem. Stay out of my sex life. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my finances. Stay out of my parenting. Stay out of this. Stay out of that. And brick by brick, I built the damn thing back up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the youngest guy in the group when I came in who was staying sober. Now I'm this, you know, my sponsor is this big 12-step guy, and I'm his wingman. And so I'm doing 5 and 10 minute talks, and I'm going to jails and prisons, and I'm starting to sponsor some guys. Everybody, you know, wow, this kid is really doing it. Inside, I'm saying, can't you see? I'm dying. I am, at 7 years of sobriety, I was in as much trouble as I was when I walked in the front door of AA. I'm back in as much debt. I owe over a year's salary in debt that I, after I had paid off all my initial debt. Every area of my life was in serious trouble. I used to say, except my marriage, and Linda said, well, you didn't understand. there was more trouble than you were able to identify. And I thought, this is the story of my life. I'm a great starter, I'm a poor friend. My mother always said, you're not very bright, Bob, dress well. And I, it is. I thought, this is one more thing where I look like I'm doing it okay, and I'm dying. I'm on my way out. I'm not going to drink, but I'm thinking about putting a gun in my mouth. I mean, a 31-year-old guy, 30-year-old, thinking about putting a gun in his mouth. Because I can't, and I'm surrounded by the answer, and I can't implement the answer. And at 7.5 years of sobriety through step 6 and 7, which I think Sandy's going to do again, which I'm really looking forward to, I went through the steps for the third time in 6 or 7 years. And what I had lost was step 2. I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was powerless. I knew my life was unmanageable. But I had been trying to manage it and failing. And I lost the sense of hope that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, because I'm busting my britches and I'm an active member of AA, and I have many of the merit badges which we think you're supposed to have in AA, and my pants are in fire and I'm going down in flames. And I went through the steps for the third time and I regained step 2. I believed it for us but not for me. And I had to come back to find that relationship with a power greater than myself. That is not a belief in a sense. It's more of a faith thing. It is, I had a lot of belief. I've been raised a Catholic and had been participating in that religion throughout. But that wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for something spiritual, and I wasn't able to fully, I had this sense of separation. My behavior separated me. I still had lingering behaviors which blocked me. And I felt unworthy. I felt broken. I felt bad. I have, you know, my mantra, you're supposed to have a mantra. My mantra was, you're an asshole and your life doesn't work. If you get down under everything, I'm not kidding. I'm a jerk and my life doesn't work. Not a very effective way to, you know, look at yourself in the process. And I had to gain access to the second step, and I had to regain a powerful access with the third step, which in the book, you know, when they talk about if you want to come over to the house and tell your story or make a decision, in popular parlance today, would we use that language? Come over to the house to make a decision? You know, I'll make a decision. It's like a throwaway. It's like, but the way and the context in which those early men talked about the third step, making a decision was a big deal. You couldn't go to the big meeting in the living room until you had gone upstairs, got down on your knees, and made a decision. We overcomplicate the steps, I think, to some degree. There were six when before Bill wrote the big book. But when you read Bill's story, when he talks about he took most of the steps in the hospital room. Okay. Now, today we would say, well, those were incomplete. I mean, but I think he did a pretty good job. And after that, he had his spiritual awakening. After that, he had his big bang, and he was never the same. Those experiences need to be nurtured. And the continuation of the steps and the continuation of the process is what nurtures them. So I came, in the second step, when we talk about coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, I think we sometimes miss the boat that God is not going to restore us to anything other than what we are. He isn't going to make me Sandy. I don't need to be Sandy. I need to be restored to who I really am. And there is something about me that is beyond the accidental collection that I brought into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's something beyond me. There's a soul. There's an integrity. There is a piece of the original equipment manufacturer that is pure, untouched, and clean. And when I get restored to that, it's kind of like my other self. Many philosophers talk about true self, false self. That's what we're restored to. And most of us are scared to death of making a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God for a couple of reasons. We don't know who God is, and we don't know who we is. Sandy talked about that last night. But there is a knower. So in AA, if you took a circle and said everything in the circle is everything there is to know, and you took a piece of the pie and said that's what you know, you take another piece of the pie and said that's what you don't know, the rest of the pie is what you don't know and don't know you don't know. Almost everything of significant importance to most of us when we walk into AA, as time goes on, is what we didn't know and didn't know we didn't know. Okay? So it is to get to experience that, you have to drop the old ideas and many of the old beliefs. The God of our understanding that we are about to turn our will over is not our historic God. It is not our childhood God. It is the God of our understanding. It is God as we understood Him. It gives each of us a chance to be our own theologian. There is no exactness about it. All you need is a power greater than yourself that allows you to go through the process of the steps. As you start to go through the process of the steps, you will change and alter because of the experience you have. And what you end up with your understanding of a higher power, is not a belief, is not a dogma, is not an idea. It is an experience. I mean, I don't know if you know how wonderful that is in our fellowship, that we rely not on belief. We don't care a lot. When a person gets up and let me tell you what I believe, we're not as interested in that as a person who says, let me tell you my experience. And we have a great tolerance for the width and variety of what that experience is when we come to that understanding. That deepens and changes, and it deepens and changes by the observations and experiences that we have with that power and that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. The struggle that most people have, say, I don't know who God is, exactly what to do, don't worry about it. Okay. The most important thing is that you understand the need for a power greater than yourself. If you don't have a power greater than yourself, you are self-directed. And that is the large, if someone said, what's the largest single impediment to most of our progress in Alcoholics Anonymous or recovery? It's being self-directed. The book talks about self-centeredness as the root of our problem. It is as pernicious and it is just everywhere. I mean, it is just everywhere. You see those shadows out there? Those are people. I mean, it is. I mean, we are just so self-involved that we don't. Every place in the world encourages control and expertise. Every place in the world is trying to say, you just need more money, faster horses, bigger houses, $300 sunglasses, $6 coffee cups, bigger cars. I mean, it is just, the message is you're not okay the way you are, we're going to get you okay. You're suffering, poor baby, we're going to give you a medication, we're going to give you a credit card. You do not have to, we should not have to wait, you should not have to have problems. That is not some places, that is every place. Okay? Today, you can take a computer in your room and you can have sex, gambling, and order medication. They had that when I went, whatever happened to Bob? He died in his bedroom. he starved to death. He actually forgot to eat. It was a... You couldn't get in the trouble that we can get into today. A $2,000 checking plus line might have been the extent of the trouble that we could get ourselves into. The wind's blowing 60 miles an hour. I mean, they have medications taken as prescribed, take you down in a relatively short period of time and addict you sometimes to the point that you need to be hospitalized as prescribed, as you. It's just epidemic the amount of people who I've seen that have trouble with some of the stuff that's going on. We had Librium and Valium and some, we had some stronger stuff, but it's just extraordinary. Our strength, just like the Apostle Paul talked about, is in our weakness. We have more teaching on the 12 steps today than we've ever had before. And we go to these things and someone's going to give us a tip, teach us how to do the fourth step with more detail and give me more insight. We don't need more insight. Is anybody missing any insight on the... Does anybody have any new problems in the room? Looking for someone that has a problem younger than 4 or 5 years. The essential problems that we deal with ongoingly in our life are not new. They aren't new. And many of us have not uncovered those because we haven't gone as deeply into the steps. And I find that many of us have kind of a second go-around where we kind of get into the second level of things that aren't just the consequences of our drinking, where we start to get into the things that impede the fullness of our lives, that we can't maintain relationships, that we struggle. And all of life is relationships, that we have trouble with work, money, every aspect of life. Because even with our best intentions, we're self-directed. We're trying to do what's in the book. We're trying to do what's in the book. We do not have the power to do what's in the book. We are the pipe, not the well. It happens through us, not by us. That's the design. We are not designed to know what's going to happen. We are not designed to know that. We are designed to get close to our higher power. In that relationship, we don't have to know. Chamberlain, God-centered life, suffer the consequences. Self-centered life, suffer the consequences. What's the difference? There are two different worlds. In my world, in the self-centered world, I am all there is, and it is all that's happening. I am circumstance-bound. I am running my life on intellect and ego. That's all that's available. In the God-centered world, I am not as important. It is not as important. I am trying to live my life based on something other than my own will, direction, and control. Those are very different places to live your life by. So when I'm talking to my sponsor, I'm talking about an event, a conflict, something that's going on in my life, and I'm having a conversation about what would a guy with a program do? What would God have me do? Now you ask that question, you want Aaron, I mean you're getting in a pretty good neighborhood. You have many of us can ask that question and still screw up, but because it isn't absolute, it isn't complete, it's conditional. Okay? So if we're wondering today, the biggest issue that I see today with myself is that I'm trying to operate my program through what I know and through psychology. I know a lot. Ask me a question. I can do 5 minutes on most aspects of the program. Okay? But I have a problem living it. Okay? Why? I'm in the way. You can't, it's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. I mean, you cannot operate just on what you know. It is a little too cute, but what we know and the words are the menu. You can starve to death eating the menu. Knowing is the booby prize. I am not saying don't study the book. I am not saying it's not our text. But it is, in the Zen parlance, the finger pointing to the moon. all the idiot sees is the finger. They are the words to bring you to the door. But you have to open the door. You have to have that unique experience that you have, the change of heart. In some ways, you've got a bunch of 70-year-old men, not all, older guys. And as you get older in life, you start to abandon doing and you start to get more into being. Because a lot of the things get taken from you, or given away in retirement and in your, some of your physicality, some of your athleticism, some of your sexuality, some of your finances, your life changes. And you start to really be, not force, but what you have, you start to look for, what am I aside from my doing? And what you are is your being. And that, when Sandy talked about being eternal and being eternal love, we're in a process. The process of, and a young person, it's really hard to talk about, what you need to do is find God. When the meetings got too spiritual, we had an upstairs and downstairs in my AA group. When the upstairs meeting got too spiritual, I went to the downstairs meeting. I believed all of it, but I just had a high level of discomfort with my experience with my church, and I had not digested it. I had not become an adult with relation, to discover what I believed. And the gratitude I have that AA is spiritual and not religious is just profound. And yet we are moving towards orthodoxy. We are moving towards, if you don't believe this, if you don't do this, you're not a good AA. There aren't anybody in the room when we talked about, we're not seeking perfection. We're in the process of, or we're seeking perfection. We are not perfect. We are not able to do this. It is done through us, not by us. When you're earlier in the program, it's easier to explain why we need to do it in the absence of what happens if we don't do it. In the absence of not having a relationship with your sponsor, with the program, with God, with the book, you only have a relationship with yourself. And it doesn't work. It just flat doesn't work. You might not stay sober, and if you stay sober, you're going to be out of control. It does not work. As you go through life, you start to realize most of us are resistant. I very much did not want to turn my sex life over to God. I very much did not want to turn my finances over to God. I had this lingering idea that God wanted me to be poor and happy. which, being a materialist and, being on the road that I was on was not what I was interested in. And so I had a lot of intellect, I had a lot of ego resistance to turning my will and my life over to the care of God. I can tell you as I get old that I think what I am in my essence is almost identical to God. I am not God, but it's like a cell of my hand. If you take a cell of my hand, that cell is not everything Bob Bazans is, but everything that cell is Bob Bazans. I think that the process of finding God is a process of coming home. It is not the process of improvement. There is a place inside of us. There is a knower. You sit in meetings, you listen last night when Sandy says something, and your soul goes, oh yeah. It doesn't go, isn't that interesting? It goes, oh yeah. It just knows. It doesn't think. It just knows. We have a knower behind the ego. And time and time again, in our experience, one of the great things about our book, I believe it's inspired, when you read great inspired literature, it's always new. If you're reading it casually, it might not be new, but when you're reading it and you're engaged, we think they've added sentences or paragraphs or moved pages around or something like that. It is always new. Okay? Time and time again in our book talks about when Jung talks about, to Roland Hazard, about these sudden, replacements. When Silkworth talks about the emotional displacements. He talks about them as being sudden. All of a sudden, and there are, 20 different times in the book or more where they talk about all at once. Spiritual experiences are both over a long period of time, and they're all at once. And I believe we came in through the surrender experience. Our pilot light got lit, and all at once we were in the game. We were teachable, listening, willing to attend meetings, and willing to engage some advice. Limited, yes, but eons different than how we were prior to coming into the program. Much of our defenses were down. Our ego had collapsed for a period of time. And we talk about that as the honeymoon period of time. And in that period of time, we did believe that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God couldn't would if he were sought. We may not have fully have understood those things, but we found ourselves doing what those things directed us to do. The book says now we're at step 3, but we spent 100 pages in the book, or 90 pages in the book, talking about our powerlessness and the need to find a power greater than ourselves, just to start, just open the door, put the key of willingness in, resign from the debating club. And when that happens, when you start to move in that direction and you're going to a lot of meetings, and the reason we need to go in a lot of meetings is we walk in here with an internal dialogue that is killing us. And we think it's us. We think that's the true us talking to ourselves. In meditation, you find out you can't stop your thinking. If you're the thinker, stop it. We can't. Thinking originates someplace else. Every once in a while, one has Velcro on it, usually the ones that are about us, and we slap it on our eyeball, and it becomes our reality for whatever that period of time that we engage it. Later, we learn that we do not have to get on every train that goes through the station and lock ourselves. Yeah. But what's our problem mostly today? It is we are still offered that internal dialogue. When we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have that collapse, and we then start to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that restores us to sanity, and we make a decision to turn our will, our thinking, and our lives, our actions, over to the care of God. And then we start to develop an enlarging our idea of that power greater than ourselves. If that is different than who we are, there's conflict, there's a resistance, there's this kind of, I'll do this, but I won't do that. As time goes on, we start to listen to the stories that we tell each other in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are not just ideas. We're looking at someone's life. When the two guys called on me in the booth from AA and sat down with me, the first time I'd been in front of every kind of help you can put a young man in front of, and those two guys told me the drinking story, they had more they changed my life. In an hour and a half, they changed my life, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a couple of early slips, and on December the 10th I came in like July, so I had two drinking episodes during that period of time. They changed my life. My life was never the same from the day those two men sat in the booth and told me their story. I had never been, there's a power in relating yourself that is beyond that. And that's what we do in meetings with each other all the time. That's what we do with work with the book, with our sponsors. And it is significantly an individual, and what we're offered is a new life. We walked in here with the consequences of our old life, and what we change is not, we can't change the past, but what we can change is what's next. We're offered the freedom to change what's next. In AA, when we go through those early steps, all of a sudden a new conversation enters our consciousness. I don't know how you describe it. I mean, if someone would have grabbed me by the butt in early in life and said, what's life all about? I would not have known. 3 or 4 months after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, if someone would have grabbed me by the butt and said, what's it all about? I would have known but not been able to tell. And I didn't even have the words to even say it to myself, but I had a sense that I was now in a place where I had access to who I am and what it's about. I don't know if there's, Sandy talked about that, those are the most important things in life, or maybe those questions. Who am I? The context of so many young people that come into AA, as I was when I came into AA. When I came in, most of the people had been churched, married, they had careers, and they had something to return to. Many of the young people today don't have anything to return to. Many of the pillars of support are not intact. It is not rehabilitation, it is habilitation. But think of Chamberlain, probably one of the wisest men we've ever had in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most gifted, one of the men who had changed literally the communication in AA. When I came in AA and you went to a conference, most of the talks were drunkologues. Started with the first drink, ended with the last drink, and spent 5 minutes of the talk talking about the kids, the job, and the family. But yet, even in that simple communication, everything was included. It was intimated. It was the presence of the person giving the talk. It was not absent of many of the things we talk about in such detail today. It was there. But today, because we have people that are 30, 40, 50 years sober, today we have people sobering up in their 20s, many more people sobering up in their 20s and teens than we used to. And the question sitting in the audience is, now what? Now what? And that's, I think, one of the reasons these conferences, the Woodstocks, have drawn so much. It is, now what? And that's an ongoing question that each of us could ask ourselves as we deepen and continue our journey through the steps. But the access to that, is in the first three steps. In our area, we do get a little intellectual. In our area, because we talk so much about the steps and we have so much treatment, the fifth step was always kind of the seminal rite of passage that we went through in Alcoholics Anonymous. And still today, if someone's got trouble, what do you hear people say? I'm going to inventory that. Saying, what do you think you're going to learn? You've had the problem for 15 years. You know. $6,000 suit, no underwear. When the hell are you going to, you know, you're not missing anything. You're not missing anything. And what I'm missing regularly is step 1, 2, and 3. I'm missing my essential powerlessness. It is my, and it is not, I go to mostly mixed groups. Women struggle fiercely with, you know, those chapters to the family, the chapters to the wife, their identity. A number of women who I am around suffer from this idea of powerlessness as they talk about it, disenfranchising themselves, reducing themselves. It's what they've been struggling with, you know, is different for a guy than it is for a woman. I think there's some truth in that. I don't know enough about how truth that is because I haven't had that full experience going through life. But powerlessness in our program is our freedom. It's our strength. It is not about personality. It is not about doing. It is about giving you access to the power. I mean, you come in here with this big ball that, you know, you've taken your perfect magnet and dragged it through the junkyard of life and you throw up here with a 6-foot round ball of crap. And then through the steps and conversations, you start to steam clean the damn thing. You start to find out that in the center of it is kind of a shiny, beautiful object, kind of weird, didn't know exactly what it was, and you get it down and someone tells you, it's a lamp. There's a lamp. There's something very cool, jeweled, gold, it's just wonderful. 2 years into the deal, you get a cord. Year or so later, you get a bulb. And then someday you get to plug it in. Someday you get to turn it on. A little later in life, you find out that it's a 3-way bulb. We are the vehicle through which the power passes. That does not make us less. It makes us, it is our design. Our design is not to be the power. Our design is not to have control. Our design is to be the vehicle. When we are the vehicle, when we are plugged in, turned on, and connected, we are now in the proper operating position. In some sense, we're an ant on a log going down a river. It looks like we're steering it, but it is an illusion. Now, you can position yourself on the log and cooperate with the process and have a wonderful life if we're connected to the power, to the source. And in that less importance of self, in that process, we can make changes that when we're all there is, when we're the most important person, this is who I am. I mean, if I get rid of that, I don't know. If I get rid of all my defects of character, good luck. I'm going to be the hole in the donut. You're going to be. This is a design. This is getting rid of what's in your way. You're in a journey. You're in a path. You're in a journey to find out who you really are in the business of your own life. Many of us, the gift is still under the piano, wrapped with the ribbon on top. We've never got the top off the damn thing to find out what instrument we're supposed to play in the orchestra of life. And to have that sort of freedom to not know, not knowing, living in the question, as you start to get into the program, is probably more powerful for many of us than living in the answer. The answer is a throwaway. The answer is a head thing. The answer is, I know. Okay? I know you know. How's your demonstration? When I ask myself that question, wouldn't you rather know? I mean, I have the answer. But the answer is the booby prize. But if you want the demonstration, if you want to get the things out of the way that are hindering yourself, it is not about finding out that you're a bad person. It is about liberating your true self. It's about coming home. At the bottom, when you come home, when you go through that process, at the bottom, at the essence of self, where your soul is the presence of God. What God wants for you is what you want for you. It's what your true self wants for you. Not the little games. So it is a treasure map. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but my heart's beating out of my chest and my head's like spinning. 20 years ago when I was sitting in a prison cell in upstate New York, I knew that God was real. That was not enough to keep me sober. It was through the kind acts of strangers like Bob and Joe and Sandy that were willing to come back and share through their life experience some of the struggles they met along the way, along that journey to discover who they really were, and I am honored and in awe. And if you're here today, please, please, please continue to keep seeking. Thank you, Bob.